Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 8th, 2007 at approximately 9:30 a.m. We're here in the State Capitol Building, Room 412 in Pier for the regular meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. We'll begin by doing a quick roll call to see who we have on the phone line. Brad Klein.
Hi, this is Brad Klein at the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Klein. Dave Prezak. Mr. Prezak, without a tail? Okay. Ms. Aberle with MDU?
Yes, I'm here, Chairman.
Great, thanks. Mr. Brink with Black Hills Power?
Yes, I'm here, and also I have Walker Witt, who is Vice President and General Counsel with Black Hills Electric Co-op, and Robbie Serra, who is our Construction Supervisor Manager for Black Hills Power.
Great, Mr. Brink, can you say those names one more time?
Yes, Walker Witt.
Okay.
Vice President and General Counsel with Black Hills Electric Co-op.
Sure, and Robbie?
Rob Usera.
Okay, great.
Construction Representative Supervisor for
the project.
Is joining the meeting.
Great, we got Mr. Prozick with us. Ms. Siebold.
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thanks. Mr. White.
Yes, this is Jim White with the Sidley Austin Law Firm in Washington, D.C. I'm responsible for coordinating federal and state permitting for the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline Project.
Thank you very much, Mr. White. Ms. Scott, and is listening on the web. All right. Ms. Stewart.
This is Susan Stewart from Mid-American Energy Company. Mr. Chairman.
All right. Wonderful. Thanks. Mr. Wilcox.
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thanks. Is there anybody on the telephone line that we've neglected to call off? With that, we'll proceed with the agenda of our meeting. Item number one under Consumer Reports is a status report on consumer. I should mention this is Commissioner Dusty Johnson and Commissioners Gary Hansen and Steve Kohlbacker also here in Pier. Again, item number one is a status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the Commission. Ms. Gregg.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 123 contacts since the last report was prepared for the April 24th, 2007 Commission meeting. 14 of the contacts involved telecommunications services, 18 contacts involved electrical services, 12 contacts involved natural gas, 4 contacts involved cellular phone service, 67 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 8 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 810 of the 977 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved, and 2,199 of the 2,466 complaints received in 2006 have been resolved.
Thanks much, Ms. Gregg. Any questions by commissioners or advisors? Now, how long do we normally have a large number of concerns or complaints outstanding from the previous year? I mean, how long does that normally go into?
We try to keep contacting them for about 6 months, try to keep them open, send them a letter every few months, because some of them are complaining about bills from a telecommunications provider. So we try to get those, and now it's helped that we have an 800 number for faxes, because some people find it expensive to fax things to our office. So that has helped getting information from the consumers to us.
Would you say that a lot of those outstanding complaints from all six are because of, limited responsiveness by the complainant?
Right, and some of them are actually open dockets on Dish Network complaints, so some of those are open too.
Great, thanks very much. Other questions? Hearing none, we'll proceed to the electric portion of the agenda. Item number one is EL06-018, and it's in the matter of the consideration of the new purpose standards. And the question before the commission today is simply, how shall the commission proceed? Probably worth noting that we did have a purple workshop that I felt was well attended and certainly had great presentations at that. And at this time, we'll turn over to Ms. Wiest for any comments she might have about how the commission should proceed.
Thank you, Chairman. After the workshop, and I agree that I think it did provide a lot of useful information, but at this point, I guess I would throw out to the parties a recommendation that perhaps the commission should now go to a hearing process. And the purpose of the hearing process would be to hear from all of the affected utilities. For example, or possibly affected utilities, we haven't heard from all of the affected utilities on all of the issues yet, and I believe that would be beneficial. And it would also provide an opportunity under our rules for other people to make comments at this public hearing. And if the commission were to decide that it could wanted to go forward with that, a possible date would be May 30th. And I think after that public hearing, what the commission could do is it could decide, it could rule on whether it wanted to adopt its standards or not, or there are other options. It could direct staff to work with utilities to see if they could come up with utilities and other interested persons to see if they could come up with any negotiated type standards, or I think there are a number of options it could explore after the hearing. So that would be my proposal at this time.
You know, perhaps we'll give, maybe first we'll look to Mr. Solem, Ms. Van Bakker from staff to see if they have any concerns with that recommendation or any other comments.
This is Kara Van Bakker for staff. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff doesn't have concerns with the recommendation and really is up for anything. We're excited to learn more about these standards and certainly will put all the time you'd possibly want us to into research, into negotiation, to come up with standards should you want to adopt some or a modified version of them. So certainly we would agree with the recommendation of Ms. Weiss. Thank you.
Some months ago when we tried to determine what the right process would be, I think the affected utilities indicated they would prefer a paper hearing. You know, I will mention that a number of the utilities did not file anything, and I think those utilities that did file something, in some cases the information was very helpful. In others, there were instances where I would have preferred additional information. Perhaps at this time we'll turn it over to any of the affected utilities to get their take on the Ms. Weiss recommendation to move toward an in-person hearing.
Chairman, this is Tammy Eberle with Montana Dakota Utilities Company. We also will take the time necessary to work through the standards. Our recommendation holds that we believe we could cover that through a paper hearing, and if it were requiring additional comments in addition to what has been provided. Montana Dakota has not submitted written comments, so we had a little issue with the service list, but we could certainly follow up in writing written comments, providing additional information or really summarizing, I guess, what we've already provided at the workshop. So that would be our recommendation is to follow with that process, the paper hearing.
Thanks, Ms. Eberle. Any other affected utilities?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Wilcox, XL Energy here. We would concur with Ms. Eberle's comments, too.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Wilcox. Mr. Kennecke at the mic here in Pier.
Good morning, commissioners and staff. I know that Northwestern Energy also would agree with that as a general proposition to move forward with comments in writing rather than otherwise. Past that, I can't elaborate much on the position, but they do agree with the position espoused by MDU and apparently XL Energy here this morning.
I'll break with Black Hills Power, and we generally would agree with that recommendation to proceed with the paper hearing at this point. And then if the commission and staff wanted to reconsider and maybe direct us to a live hearing at that point or direct us with the more specific questions, that might be appropriate.
Well, Commissioner Johnson here again, and I do understand how, for most proceedings, a paper hearing would be more efficient. It seems to me that the comments we've received thus far from affected utilities do a pretty good job of, you know, laying out why they think it might be cumbersome or unnecessary to this commission to adopt the standards. It seems to me that there was less information on how those standards should be adopted if the commission was interested in doing so. And I just wonder if a live hearing might not provide more of an opportunity for a given day, a give and take, a collaborative opportunity for us to discuss, you know, well, if we were interested in doing this, how best should we proceed? Any thoughts? Isn't a paper hearing a little cumbersome for that give and take process?
Mr. Jim Wilcox here. I think for us it's a matter that there are several disparate issues here, and I've got subject matters scattered across our service territory, and to try to gather them, enough of those folks up in one place in one day is just, I think, the cumbersome aspect. I think for us, a paper it would be more efficient because I could farm out questions to those subject matter experts and get replies back without having to bring them all to peer on the same day.
Well, I'm Commissioner Johnson here again. You know, I normally like to rip the Band-Aid off pretty quickly, but we do have two of these four standards that don't need to be dealt with until next year. I mean, I guess maybe in the – Mr. Wilcox, would you be more accepting of having a hearing on the two standards that need to be dealt with by this August?
Well, Commissioner, we're willing to go along with whatever you think we need to do. I'm just making the case that it would be difficult for me to get enough everybody that I want to have in the room on the day that you want to do it.
This is Susan Stewart from Mid-American. I guess I might make kind of a suggestion that maybe kind of in between. Would it be possible for the commission to maybe ask us some pretty specific questions? Maybe you want to ask us just how we should implement the standards, or even more specific than that, ask if they should be implemented in any specific direction. And then maybe after you have that paper information, perhaps there could be a live hearing. I do agree with Mr. Wilcox. I've got people all over on these issues, but I think even with the three standards, I think it's a long day.
Well, yeah, no doubt. Ms. Wiest, any comments regarding what's been said?
One possible option when they're talking about trying to bring people in on the day and everything is I think the commission could consider actually having these people join by phone also. I guess my point is we've already put out a number of written questions to the parties. We had three of the parties respond, and it just seemed to me from the workshop that as you stated, Mr. Chairman, that it would be much more productive to have some sort of give and take where you could follow up with questions and ask more specific questions. And I also do have that time constraint with respect to the interconnection standard and the metering standard. So to go to written comments and then say, oh, well, maybe we need more information, let's have a hearing then, I think that would be problematic.
This is Brad Klein from ELPC's. A couple comments?
Yeah, go ahead. Proceed, okay. Mr. Klein.
Thanks, Chairman. To give some perspective from other states that have been kind of going through the same process, I think the idea is a good one to have some kind of workshop where there can be give and take. But in both Iowa and Illinois, and Ms. Stewart may be able to provide more background on this as well. The parties started with rounds of comments similar to what you've done in South Dakota. And then in Illinois, we've been having a series of workshops on the interconnection standards topic. And we've had three workshops so far, and I think the parties have come a real long way towards reaching a consensus how to move forward there, and I feel like with written comments, it is nice to be able to respond to specific questions, but I think the parties tend to take a pretty conservative position when they're required to put something down in writing, and it's more of a litigation scenario where you're not really willing to take a compromise position because it's down in writing. But once you get the parties in the same room around the table, I think you can make a lot of progress, and it's easier to kind of go back and forth with questions. One suggestion you may want to consider is, if you go the workshop route, is to maybe narrow the focus and just take on one of the purpose standards, or the workshop, or have maybe parallel proceedings, because it could be a pretty long day if you try to do too much in one day. But and also we did have parties participate in Illinois over the phone through conference calls. We had some people join for parts of the day to kind of give an overview of specific sections and then drop off, and I think that worked pretty well.
Ms. Wiest, how did you envision, you know, a possible future hearing? Were you thinking that all four standards would be taken up, or were you interested in focusing and having the commission focus in more on the couple that are up in August?
I guess I was thinking of all four standards, but I could certainly see the benefits to just focusing on the interconnection and the metering at this point in time. And that way it would have, you know, there would be less people involved on each utility side. It would just be those people that are involved in that. We could allow testimony by phone and questions by phone. And I just don't think it would be all that cumbersome if we went that route. It just seems to me more efficient than just having another round of written comments.
This is Commissioner Hansen. If I could ask Mr. Klein a question.
Sure.
How many of these hearings have you attended?
I've participated in the written portion in both Iowa and Illinois, and I guess we had two rounds of comments in both cases in those states. And then I've attended all three workshops in the Illinois process so far.
And not assuming that we will take the same amount of time that they would, but
right.
Approximately how much, how many days have been devoted to the process?
The workshops themselves were have been pretty much all-day workshops, but I guess you could do it in a staged approach. The first workshop was more of a general overview. It was actually similar to what you hosted earlier this month. It was kind of giving an overview of the process. And from there, what I thought was very helpful is that the staff at the Illinois Commerce Commission selected a kind of a straw man model from one of the several state and organizational models out there just to use as a focal point for discussion. And we went through that kind of topic by topic at the second workshop. And a lot of, I think, just opening up one of the model rules and taking a look at it and looking at what the specific provisions in it, I think made everyone, all the parties, a lot more comfortable with the issue because I think it's easy to kind of debate this issue in the abstract, you can kind of go back and forth and around on it. But until you actually have a document in front of you and look at what another state or one of the models has done, it helps focus the conversation quite a bit. But so far, I guess where we are in the process now, we've had three workshops. The parties are actually very close. We're going to go through point by point on one of the models next week and try to just achieve consensus on it. And then the staff at that point will make a recommendation to the Illinois Commerce Commission that the rule be adopted in Illinois. And they haven't actually decided yet whether it would be a...
So it's an extended process.
I think it would be an extended process, but it wouldn't necessarily have to involve the entire commission. It could involve, a staff working group.
Certainly.
I'm not sure.
What I was looking at was trying to get an idea of approximate time that it would take for the commission to go through the different standards that we're examining. I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the discussion on bifurcating the questions that are the standards and that are before us. If we take two in one year and two in the other year, I do agree that would probably facilitate the process for us as well as for the folks that we're going to ask to participate.
Commissioner Kolbeck.
Yes, I just have one question. As Mr. Wilcox and others have stated, it's cumbersome because there's people out there. Is peer an inhibitor? If we were to have these meetings, maybe in Rapid or Sioux Falls, would that help, or is that not a problem? It's something else.
Mr. Jim Wilcox here. I don't think that the location is a concern, and I think my question was really answered with the opportunity to have participants available on the telephone. That would really help my situation, I think.
Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Wilcox. Commissioner Kolbeck, anything further? Okay. I'm not prejudging anything here, but it seems to me, from a personal perspective, after hearing some of the information at the workshop, that there might be some value in South Dakota doing some work on the interconnection issue. I mean, I don't know if that ends up being a certain number of standards that we adopt or a framework or just even having the utilities regularly, you know, file their interconnection standards with us. I don't know what it looks like, but it seems to me that we probably should move toward doing something more. Again, there may be information I hear in the future that will change my mind, but I just mentioned that so that because I guess I would ask the affected utilities and others to start thinking about what is going to allow us to really make interconnection less of an obstacle. We've heard from some experts that it is a bit of an obstacle to distributed generation. So how can we make that less of an obstacle without being overly burdensome or cumbersome to the affected utilities? So hopefully everybody will have their thinking caps on. Anything else, Ms. Wiest?
No.
Okay. At this point, I really would lean toward having a hearing, obviously allowing telephonic participation. Ms. Wiest, is there any value in us getting an idea of what we want addressed at that topic, or do you think it's just let's get the experts in the same room or on the same telephone line and have a conversation that way? Now, in our initial announcement, on the initial order of the commission, we did have a number of relatively specific questions to be addressed.
Right.
Do you think those provide the framework for discussion, interconnection, and time-based metering?
They were, you know, somewhat more general. It is possible that we could come up with additional questions that we could put in, you know, the notice of hearing that are a little bit more specific based on what we gathered at the workshop, kind of narrow the issues.
And I also wonder, I think we have got good information from the affected utilities as to maybe why the standards are unnecessary. You know, maybe this next hearing could be more of a focus on if the commission was going to adopt the standards, what would be the most appropriate.
Exactly, right.
Great. Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes, I thank you, Chairman. I know that a lot of the comments, either for or against, but kind of along your lines, I'd like to know what their plans would be after they were adopted. Hypothetically, if they were adopted, what would happen? I guess that's more of the answers I need right now. It's pretty obvious if we don't adopt them, what they would do. But if we were to take them into effect, adopt them, I need to know how exactly that's going to affect the companies and how exactly they plan to implement them. That's more what I'm after.
At this point, I would be interested in moving that we have an additional hearing on only the two purpose standards that need to be dealt with prior to August of this year, and we just ask, you know, the executive director and Ms. Wiest to schedule an appropriate date. With that, a motion's been made. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Are we going to entertain any without commissioners, maybe just staff and maybe Ms. Wiest and Mr. Smith and companies before we get to a hearing?
And this is just my take. It seems to me that we're still at the 30,000-foot level where I think commissioner input is vital. Once we get a better idea of which direction maybe it's appropriate to go, then I do think, you know, a staff working group or sort of something at the subcommissioner level is probably invaluable. And if Ms. Wiest disagrees with that or staff disagrees with that, please pipe up.
No, I agree.
Okay, thanks. Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you very much to everyone. With that, we will proceed to item number 2 under electricity. It's EL07-013. It's in the matter of the joint request for an electric service territory boundary change between Black Hills Electric Cooperative and Black Hills Power. Question for the commission today is, shall it grant the joint request for an electric service territory boundary change? At this time, we would turn toward the parties, either Black Hills Electric Cooperative or Black Hills Power, for their comments.
Yeah, this is Todd Brinks for Black Hills Power, and I'm also here with Walker Witt with Black Hills Electric. Really, item 2 and item 3 are kind of go together on the agenda.
If you would like, Mr. Brink, we can go ahead and take up agenda item number 3 at the same time if you want to speak to them both.
Sure.
Yeah, at that time we'll take up EL07-014 at the same time. Go ahead, proceed.
Thank you. Essentially what we have is a territory swap between Black Hills Electric and Black Hills Power. In the Red Rock subdivision, Black Hills Electric is changing the boundary lines to give Black Hills Power 5 lots in the Sunset development, proposed development area. Black Hills Power is giving Black Hills Electric 5 lots. All of the affected landowners have filed their agreement with this swap, and essentially it avoids the duplication of facilities and would be a cost savings to the customer ultimately. That would be a summary. I don't know if Walker has anything to add on behalf of Black Hills Electric.
No, I concur with Todd.
Thanks very much. At this time, we'll look towards staff, Mr. Solem, Mr. Bettman, Ms. Kramer, for their comments.
Commissioner, this is Martin Bettman with staff. We would echo what Black Hills Power and Black Hills Electric Co-op have said about the transfer and would agree and recommend approval.
Thanks very much. Any comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Mr. Bettman, I seem to remember reading that there are very few number of people at this point affected by these swaps, that most of these lots are vacant at this time. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding also, yes.
There's at least one landowner affected that I remember. Obviously, he or she is aware of this and has no problems.
There are signature pages in the docket for everybody.
Okay, thanks very much. Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Commissioner Kobach.
Mr. Martin, is there, am I reading the maps wrong, or is there still two lots that are split in half? How does that work?
On which
one? On
which one? On the
Red Rock. Sorry, I'm sorry, Sunset.
On Sunset.
Sunset Creek, there's the lots that were over, and then is the territorial boundary still going through lots, looks like 18 and 7? Am I reading that wrong?
I'd have to ask Black Hills Electric. I'm assuming Black Hills Electric already claims those.
Yeah, the line that dissects those two lots is actually, that's the existing line.
Okay.
When you look at the map, it's then the line that goes back down around lot 19, lot 20, lot 21, and back over across lot 8. That would be the new line.
Okay.
That's what we're trying to avoid is this dissection of the lot.
But there are no customers in 16 or 18 and 7 at this time, right?
Okay, right. Yep, I was just looking at the maps wrong. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
It's a proposed development area. The only affected customer is lot 15. They're not the proposed customer, and he has consented to the territory swap. And actually, it would be a direct cost savings to him because he would he'll save having to line move and things of that nature.
Thanks very much. Commissioner Kobach, any further questions?
No, thank you.
Great. Any other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, does anyone have a motion?
I'll motion in the case of EL07-013 and EL07-014 that the commission grant the joint request for electric service territory boundary changes.
Motion's been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kobach?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Those two motions carry 3-0. Proceed to the natural. Thank you very much. We'll proceed to natural gas. Item number one is NG07-010. It's in the matter of the filing by Montana Dakota Utilities Company for approval of tariff revisions. And the question for the commission today is, shall it approve the tariff revisions? At this time, we'll look to MDU to explain the filing.
Thank you, Chairman John. Commissioners, before you is to recognize a distinct, albeit small, class of customers that are part of the larger general service classes in regard to Montana Dakota's reconnection of service policy. Those customers are the off-peak seasonal customers such as grain dryers, irrigators, and asphalt processors that typically operate for only a few months of the year, but also typically use more natural gas than the average customer during that time in service. The proposal before you is a modification to the general provisions, Rate 100, Paragraph 18, relating to seasonal reconnects. Montana Dakota's authorized policy provides for a reconnect fee equal to the basic service charge times the days out of service. This recognizes that fixed costs are not avoided when customers disconnect service for several months and reconnect again. Under the proposal, the revisions for the seasonal non-space heating business entities will be allowed a credit for the DK usage that is above the class average for the time and service for the sole purpose of determining the reconnect charge. The reconnect charge would then be calculated based on the days out of service, less the result of multiplying the decatherms above the average class use by the authorized distribution charge. The minimum reconnect charge of $30 will still apply to all customers. This modification recognizes that customers qualifying for this application of the reconnect charge utilize natural gas during off-peak periods and typically use more volumes in their business season than the average annual use of other customers. Therefore, we believe the proposed tariff provision is justified for the following reasons. The seasonal customers are not contributing to distribution capacity costs in the same degree as on-peak space heating customers, and the seasonal business customers are contributing more than the average customer toward fixed costs due to the higher volumes of natural gas used. We request approval of the tariff sheet filed with the Commission on March 29 and as revised on May 7. Thank you, and I'm available for questions.
Thanks very much, Ms. Aberle. At this time, we will turn to staff to get their comments. Mr. Jacobson, Ms. Van Bakkeren.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Dave Jacobson. I think Tammy pretty much went through many of the points I was going to make. The changes, just to re-clarify, the changes from the original filing, now only above-average usage customers are eligible for this, and the idea being that they contribute more towards fixed costs than the average customer, in essence, for within that rate class, could be considered, paying more than their assigned fixed cost. The other change made to direct this more towards off-peak customers, it's specifically for non-space heating customers. So by pointing it toward those type of customers, you avoid capacity additions. These customers would not be responsible for that type of cost. Staff can accept the filing as it is filed now, and as supported by the cost basis the company has explained. But there still is one underlying concern that any time that I answer the phone throughout the year, and I get quite common. It's customers call in and ask, "How come I have to pay customer charges?" Even though I'm not taking service, I would disconnect in the summer, and why do I need to pay customer charges for those periods? I think the company has justified why this can be approved in this case. However, it's still a matter of residential, in this case it'll be residential customer perception of, if they think this is fair or not. We can explain cost-wise why it may be fair, but and maybe in that regard, I would ask Tammy. This is in effect in North Dakota, isn't it, right?
Yes, it is.
And it's probably been in effect quite a long time, so customers are either used to it or are aware of it, or maybe not aware of it.
It has been in place for, I believe, two seasons, and we have not had, significant issues with other customers. It addresses the customer at hand, and we have not had any that I'm aware of, residential or other firm general customers alluding to some of the issues that you discussed, Dave.
Okay. The other thing I would just ask is, and we talked about this a little bit, but how many customers specifically requested this, and is that where this filing really came from, is customer request?
It was highlighted by
customer requests, and it was it is a very small number. I had two in particular that I am aware of, but it highlighted that it would be appropriate to reflect that for those seasonal business customers. So, you know, it wasn't a large group of customers.
Yeah. Well, considering that experience that they just spoke about, I think we'd recommend approval. They have shown that there's cost justification for doing this, and hopefully we won't experience any more customer reaction than occurred in North Dakota. So.
Thanks very much, Mr. Jacobson. Any commissioner advisor comments or questions? Commissioner Kolbeck.
Yes, basically this is for, I guess, seasonal items, correct? It's not necessarily for seasonal homes, say snowbirds and other things like that?
Commissioner, no, it would not be applicable to that. It is related to non-space heating customers, so it's really, there's a, like an irrigator or a asphalt processor that is on during the off-peak periods, using typically large volumes of gas just in a much shorter time frame, which they just typically would cut out of service. But again, in looking at what fixed costs they have contributed, that differentiates them from the snowbird or that type of customer that is simply moving out of their home. We still need the facilities there to serve that customer during that peak condition.
Are there any other considerations taken into effect? You mentioned a hot mix plant. If the road is complete and that doesn't fire up again, are there additional charges that are charged to them for that? Or are they just, that's just a one-time deal and the company's out?
I'm sorry, Commissioner, I didn't follow that question.
Say a hot mix plant is turned up or asphalt plant is turned up and then the road is complete and that isn't used the next season. Are there additional charges for that already? Or is that kind of what this is designed to cover?
Yes, this is what we're talking about here is the reconnection charge. So it typically, if in the asphalt processors I'm referring to, they're most times out of a central location, reconnecting to the same place on the pipeline, on our distribution system.
Commissioner, maybe this would help clarify. This is only applicable where a customer drops off the system and then comes back on within one 12-month period of time.
Okay. Okay, so it's not this doesn't affect a one-shot deal.
No.
If someone sets up temporarily, they're there for 10 months and they leave.
No, as long as you stay off the system for 12 months, then the normal connection charge applies, which is, I believe, $30 or something like that.
Okay.
And just to clarify that, Montana, Dakota doesn't actually have a connection charge. Our reconnect charge does apply during that 12-month period. If a customer were off for 2 years, there isn't actually a charge to come back on the system at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Other commissioner advisor questions? Yeah, Commissioner Hansen.
Okay.
I'll hop up here. You note in your filing, in your letter, that irrigators, swimming pool facilities, grain dryers, and asphalt processors. Are there other customers that would be, obviously there are other customers that would be affected. Do they fall into any other particular types of categories other than those four main ones?
Chairman, there may be. Those are the customers we typically encounter on our system that would fall under this. Again, we would, you know, as we look at the customer, when the customer is calling in, we will look at the usage pattern of that customer. If they would qualify, they would be, the reconnection policy, as noted here, would be available to them even if they didn't fall into that one of those four categories we listed. So it's really going to be looking at their usage and when they were in service.
Well, and rather than be so coy, I guess I'll just ask the question, and that is, you know, when I think about
MDU service territory and I think about seasonal businesses, it's tough not to think of, you know, tourism-based businesses. Are there a large number of those that would be affected in ways that I'm not thinking of? I mean, you know, they're not, if they're only open during the summer, they're not doing any space heating, and presumably if they're large enough and have high enough usage, they would meet that threshold.
If they would meet the threshold, yes, it would apply to them. Again, there's probably, it needs to almost be a process. I don't believe that just simply water heating would be push them over the class average. So it really then tends toward those processing type customers. Certainly a large public swimming pool facility may, depending on that water heating, but just a typical seasonal business probably isn't using the decatherms that would provide for a credit on that reconnect charge.
You've got to make a whole lot of saltwater taffy in the back room to have that kind of usage, huh?
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Jacobson, I'm not aware of these kinds of provisions for other regulated utilities in South Dakota. Is that right?
Generally, and I looked that up just before the meeting, I couldn't find in Northwestern's tariff where it specifically addresses the situation, but in Mid-American's tariff, I believe they do have the 12 months, and that is common with gas utilities. It's much more common than not being the case. Normally, customers are charged, and it's common in the electric business, too. I mean, with regard to fixed costs, it's really when you're in a rate case and you determine what the class cost of service is, and then you divide out the amount attributable to customer charges, it only makes sense to assume people are going to take service for 12 months. If people don't, if they're able to jump on and off the system, what it creates is a cost shift over to the customers that do continually take service. And, of course, we really want to avoid that. But, you know, in this case, like I said, with the revisions that the company submitted, I think that it can be justified in this case.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
The
threshold is set at, you know, above average use for that customer class. Were there any discussions or considerations about setting a threshold higher than that? Mr. Jacobson first.
Well, I did think of that. However, too, and there is probably some merit to that as a cushion or a buffer maybe, but to pick a particular usage level it's hard to support. Above, I mean, with average, obviously there is some support, but at what level above that would you pick? Then I start grappling with how to support that. So.
Well, that was my concern as well. I mean, at least hypothetically, you could have somebody who was using, you know, just slightly over average that would be shifting cost. I mean, there still is some potential cost shifting here if this is approved. So I was trying to minimize that in my mind, but as you've noted, at least with the average number, you have something to tie it to. It's not quite so arbitrary. I was hoping you were more brilliant than I am. You are, but not in, maybe in this particular instance. So, thanks. Any other questions? Commissioner Hansen.
I don't know how to follow up that last statement you made. best I don't. I'm concerned about the possibility during peak usage that the folks that the type of companies that you're talking about are obviously large users. That's one of the particulars in being able to get this type of rate. And if they, in fact, create a higher peak usage, then isn't there infrastructure that has to be created in order to provide them with the gas? And if that's the case, then are they actually paying for the cost of that infrastructure? I'll allow anyone to take a shot at that if you would, Dave.
Yes, I understand. I mean, in looking at the customers, even the ones that were mentioned, in a really warm winter, it's possible that an asphalt plant can extend, service into the colder months. However, I think if you really look at the peak for natural gas usage, it probably occurs in January and February. It's not saying that it couldn't happen, but it's, what's been proposed is designed to avoid that. One particular method to alleviate that concern would to have change of filing so that it is period specific, in that you could certainly rule out the months of January, February, December, and just say that, for usages, just pin it down to specifically the off-peak months.
Is there I recognize that it's for non-space heating seasonal customers, and that their use has to be above the average class. Is there another qualification that provides that it can only be used for a particular number of months a year, as opposed to just...
No, not that I'm aware of.
So,
Commissioner, if I may, this provision is a reconnection charge, is what we're talking about. If they're in service, they're paying the basic service charge and their distribution delivery charge based on their usage. So there's a number of customers, for whatever reason, they may have an office building. They stay in service all year long. So even the example of the asphalt company, if it was a warm winter, most likely that customer then is never going to disconnect from service in that winter, that period. So I guess I don't see that it would be necessary to limit, based on season because of that. It really, for the most part, should take care of itself. And again, it is when it is applicable to those customers that disconnect service and then reconnect within a 12-month period.
Thank you. I was working your formula a little bit to try to figure out whether it was a detriment to someone, some entity using the seasonal rate from a standpoint of for 10 months out of the year and dropping off for 2 months and then jumping back on. And it seems like it's enough of a detriment. Is that what your analysis is, Dave?
Well, yeah, I mean, the revenue, the amount of savings if you only dropped off for 2 months of the year are extremely minimal, because we're only talking about the connection charge, like
right,
the customer charge. So, I would think in that case nobody would bother if you were only going to drop off for 2 months of the year.
I'm just trying to figure out ways in which someone can game a new type of a system. Can you give us an idea? You've told us the type of companies that might be associated with this rate. Do you have an idea of how many will be?
Commissioner, I do not, because even if we looked at usage patterns, as I stated, some customers do simply stay in. I mean, they make the business decision to stay in service, and it may be they have other smaller natural gas needs at that facility. So it is difficult for me to give you a number of who may qualify or who may disconnect service and then reconnect again and would fall under this.
Thank you. Mr. Jacobson, my last thing, what I'm really concerned with is fairness, making certain that this is fair to all ratepayers and that the cost is not pushed on to others. The cost causers are not getting a free ride. In your analysis, do you see any of that taking place?
Not with the revisions that the company has proposed. It would be possible if, like the question you just brought up, if customers in effect were using high volumes during the heating season, albeit not for space heating, maybe one way to address that is to, I don't know how many customers a company really expects to get on this, But would it be possible to in effect provide a report to the commission of the customers that elect this and when they were not taking service?
Yes, that could be provided on an annual basis.
And that way we could see exactly what's going on with this rate, and if we don't think it's, if it's not working as we hope it would, then we can change it, get rid of it.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. I think that's an excellent suggestion. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jacobson, would an annual requirement be necessary, or perhaps just for the first or second year so that we have an idea? I mean, I hate to put into perpetuity requiring, you know, filing requirements if they're not necessary.
I think that's reasonable, two or three years.
Sounds like you brought up three, so you must be comfortable with that number. So if you're comfortable with them, okay, great. Is Everly, would Montana, Dakota have any problems with that in a three-year? You mentioned you wouldn't mind a reporting requirement, so I guess I probably just answered my question. Thanks. Any other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Yeah, Mr. Rizloff.
This is Greg Rizloff for the commission. As we talk about this charge, it is a reconnection charge. We talk about warm winters where you really aren't getting into perhaps a system overall peak over a period of years. But nonetheless, I just want to go to one point on this analysis. We're talking about reconnection charges, which for most customers are going to be fairly small compared to their usage charges. And when I look at this change proposed by the company, to me it was more of a theoretical issue than it was a practical dollar issue. And I think the reason it's been chewed on so much by staff in the company and in fact myself is that we don't want to establish a theory that, you know, in some ways runs counter to the cost causer concept that we've been using for the past 20 years. And I think in case of these revisions, I think we've been chasing fairness. And I think the problems, I'm not going to put words in Dave's mouth, but the problems are more ones of perception than they are of actual fairness. And I think we have achieved something that perhaps is more fair now than it was before. And frankly, it'll never be perfect, but I think with the company and the commission staff, we're always working toward it. And I think we've, you know, I think these changes will be an improvement in the fairness quotient that this company has in the rate design, albeit it'll still never be perfect.
It's well said, Mr. Rizloff. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Commissioner Kolbach.
I just have one quick question. This is probably going to show my glaring ignorance more than anything, but would ranches or any agriculture, would they meet the demand qualifications? Are we?
Well, again, not for space heating. You know, typically natural gas service is doesn't extend very far into rural areas because of the limitation in economic feasibility of doing it. But trying to think of what a ranch might use it for other than space heating of the house, I can't really imagine.
Grain drying.
That could be used for grain drying. And that was, I think, mentioned in the filing as one of the possible uses. That again, and we talked about that, and typically grain drying is, I think, wrapped up. I'm not a farmer, but I think it's generally wrapped up by December sometime, and typically the peak usage is January and February for the gas company.
Okay.
But it may stretch if there was a large crop and, you know.
Yeah. Is that something that we could, you know, in this reporting?
It should show up in there.
It should show up in there?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Hearing none, does anyone have a motion? Waiting for Commissioner Hanson. He had that great reporting requirement. He led us toward that, so.
I move that the commission approve the tariff revisions with stipulations as recommended by staff, including a annual reporting period culminating in 3 years.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbach?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
And Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much, Ms. Aberle.
Thank you.
We'll move to telecommunications. Item number one is TC07-019. It's in the matter of the filing for approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and MCI Metro Access Transmission Services. Question for the commission today is, shall it approve the amendment to the agreement? We'll look first to Ms. Van Bakkern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Van Bakkern for staff. The amendment was properly filed and executed, does not appear to contain any discriminatory provisions. No comments were filed, and staff therefore recommends approval of the amendment.
We'll look to MCI Metro and Quest to see if either party has any comments. Ms. Siebold?
I have no comments, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks very much. Any questions or comments by commissioners or staff? Hearing none, I'll move that the commission approve the amendment to the agreement. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. The final item on our regular agenda is under administration. It is a proposed rulemaking docket. The question for the commission today is, shall how the commission proceed? At this point, we'll look to Ms. Wiest for her comments.
Thank you. This is Rolaine Wiest. As the agenda stated, the primary reason for opening up a rulemaking for telephone rules is to address Senate Bill 22, the tariffing bill. That's what we would take out requirements relating to telephone tariffs. But I would also mention that throughout the year, I keep a file of all changes that people request or want to think about with respect to rules. And so staff would propose that the commission would consider making some further changes to rules. For example, there are some changes to the security or bonding issues for COA companies, interchange as well as local, and also new notification rules for alternative operator service providers so that the customer can get notification of charges before incurring those charges on a call. In addition, the ability of the commission to waive certain provisions for local exchange, requirements for local exchange service if they're not necessary for the based on the type of service being provided. With respect to arbitration and suspension rules, we would also propose some changes with respect to perhaps filing written testimony with exhibits. And this is really with the test and exhibits and testimony with the petition. And this is actually more of a timing problem that we've run into, since under federal law we really only have about 3.5 months to do a complete arbitration. And another issue with respect to arbitrations and suspensions is how to treat non-parties to those. So we would propose a rule on that. There's one change to the ETC rules, and that's kind of a clarification with respect to filing plans beyond the initial two-year planning period. And then a minor change to some maintenance notification requirements. The final change regards, proposed change regards slamming rules, and this is an issue that has come up when, like a sale of a company and how the notification should be made to subscribers when companies sale or transfer subscribers between companies. So with that, I guess at this point I would just ask the commission to open up a rulemaking regarding changes to certain telephone rules.
Any comments by any possibly affected party? Any comments or questions by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, is there a motion? I would move, sorry, go ahead, Commissioner Hanson. I would move that the commission open up a rulemaking docket to deal with certain telecommunications rules. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries. Is that everything you needed with that, Ms. Wiest? Great, thanks very much. With that, we'll proceed to the addendum of the to the commission, to our regular commission meeting. The only item, it deals with a hydrocarbon pipeline. It is HP07-001. It's in the matter of the application of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP for a permit under the South Dakota Energy Conversion and Transmission Facility Act to construct the Keystone Pipeline Project. There are a series of questions for the Commission today. First, shall the Commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $351,100 with an initial deposit of $8,000? And shall the Commission authorize the Executive Director to hire a consultant and enter into contracts with a consultant? And shall the Commission approve hearing locations and a hearing schedule? We will look first to the company, and I believe they have representation on the phone. You've been quite patient. I believe we have Mr. White on the line.
Actually, Mr. Konecki is going to speak for the company.
Okay, absolutely. Go ahead and proceed.
Good morning, Commissioners and staff. Brett Konecki from PEER, appearing as counsel for TransCanada Limited Partners on the Keystone Project. We did file an application on April 27th, and also the statutory initial filing fee of $8,000. I appreciate the staff's hard work in putting that application out there for the general public to see. We've got some work left to do with respect to the website, and I'll say that for Anissa's benefit. She's sitting here. We're working on that. The size of the filing mirrors the size of the pipeline almost. A number of computer files were well over 1 gigabyte in size, and that's presented some challenges in splitting those up so they still make sense, but can be put on the computer so that interested parties can see those. It is an exciting project. It's been a long time in the making. The pipeline will take crude oil from the oil sands in Alberta and bring it to the United States at distribution points farther down from here. The project will enter South Dakota and Marshall County and extend through to Yankton County, where it will be bored underneath the Missouri River and become a Nebraska project. After that, the company would look forward to construction in 2008 and an on-service date in 2009. And we would we do look forward very much to engaging with the commission, staff, the general public, and certainly affected landowners as to how the project will proceed in an orderly fashion. I don't know, Commissioner, how you'd like to take the several questions, if you want to take them in order, if you want to hear from me on all of them. I presume there's going to be some extended discussion about certainly the notice requirements, which are in statute for the commission, and I will leave it to you to direct me as to what you'd like to hear further at this point in time.
You know, we've got three questions. I think the first two you could probably handle relatively easy just up front, and let's leave the third until after we deal with those, if that's acceptable to my colleagues. Great. Proceed.
I have nothing about those two particular questions there. We understand. I think that the commission is going to give the staff authority to, you know, assess the top dollar on the filing fee, and then we'll expect staff to expend some portion of that, if not all of it, going forward. I don't have any further comment about that.
Well, and certainly that's the routine portion of the questions. Let's pause and look then towards staff to see if they have anything to add. Mr. Bettman, Mr. Knadel, Mr. Solem, Ms. Van Bakkern. Anything to add on those initial questions?
Nothing to add. It's, like you indicated, a routine statutory type of obligation. So nothing to add on the first questions.
And it seems as though we walk ourselves through the formula every time we have a relatively large filing fee. And so I'll just note for those listening on the Internet that there is a statutory formula that is followed as part of calculating this filing fee. If you have the statute number, go ahead, Ms. Van Bakkern, note it.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt. The formula is found in STCL 4941B12.
Great, thanks very much. And sounds as though the company didn't have any opposition to the calculation. And as a result, well, any other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, then perhaps we can move forward with at least the first couple of questions. First, I would move the commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $351,100 with an initial deposit of $8,000. Any questions or comments on that motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck.
Aye.
Hansen.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And the second question, shall the commission authorize the executive director to hire a consultant and enter into contracts with the consultant? I would move that. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Kolbeck?
Hold on a minute here on this one. You might want to discuss this with staff, unless I don't understand the question.
And I presume that these were simply contracts we often enter into consultants to do some of our review work. Is that not accurate?
No, this question was not quite clearly put on the agenda. I think that what we're really talking about here, And you can correct me if I'm wrong, staff, but from my understanding, this really should have been directed more toward owner identification services. That's what we were really, that's the urgency right now.
Well, let's go ahead and pause and hear from staff then specifically on the second question. My apologies, I thought you would address that in your brief initial comments. Obviously, I misunderstood. Go ahead and handle the second question.
And I apologize, Mr. Chairman. We were whispering over here on staff side, and I wasn't paying close enough attention to what we were doing. This question is specifically addressing the identification of landowners. According to our statutory notice requirements, staff must identify and notify all landowners within a half a mile of either side of the pipeline. And that's according to SDCL 49-41B15. And this pipeline covers a large portion of South Dakota, and staff not being trained in such type of work thought maybe we would need assistance. However, it appears as if the company who has such staff is willing to assist with this. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Kennedy at this time.
Thank you. I guess we do have something resembling a plan. We've discussed the nature of the problem with staff and with council over the past few days. The problem arises from the statute, which requires the commission to serve notice upon the owner of record of any property within 1/2 mile of a facility. Well, facility is pretty broadly defined in that statute, and pipeline is included with that, but pipeline not perhaps isn't necessarily what was in the legislature's mind when it adopted the statute requiring notice. That said, we're stuck with it. There's a waiver statute, which I don't think meets the facts squarely enough, and in discussions with my client, we've opted not to ask the commission for a waiver. We wouldn't probably talk you out of it, but we don't think that it's probably the best idea. On the other hand, though, that serving notice is not strictly defined. You know, we think of service of process being served by a sheriff's deputy. Well, that's not strictly the application of service. It can be done by first-class mayor or otherwise, as the commission might order. And if we were to take the legal description of where the pipeline is going to run, and we certainly have to notify those people ourselves, they know about the project. If the pipeline is intended to cross their property, that's been discussed. Those people who would not be directly affected, but who would be within that 1 mile wide corridor, half mile on either side, we intend to, if the commission would so order it, provide the assessors in the affected counties with lists of the pieces of property which would fit that description. In other words, if a pipeline is going through the west half of Section 1, Section 2 would be to the left of that, looking at the map. We'd provide the assessor with the description of the east half of Section 2 and the east half of Section 1, neither of which the pipeline is crossing, and ask them to tell us who the owner of record is. Who do you send the tax notice to at his address or her address? And then provide that to the commission so that the commission could send notice to those people by first-class mail. I discussed it with the Clark County assessor yesterday, asked him, you know, how could that work? He said, I could turn that around in a day or two at the most. And we think we're able to turn around listing those affected pieces of property. We wouldn't have the ability to provide notice at the level, say, the Oil and Gas Board or the Board of Minerals and Environment would require for a drilling or unitizing permit. They take those ownerships down to 6 decimal places, and that's because you're taking oil or gas that belongs to somebody and then providing them with a check in return for that. Well, we're not doing that here. We're simply giving notice to people that, hey, this pipeline's going to cross property within a half mile of yours. And I would ask, and I think staff perhaps would join me in asking the commission to order, that we would simply send notice to the taxpayer of record, the first owner on the list. You know, property is, my house is owned by me and my wife, and she might be surprised to hear that I even have any ownership in it. But you know, property can be owned by a number of different people, and if we're going to do fractional ownership interests and send notice to all of them, not only would that be expensive and time-consuming, but at some level, perhaps bothersome. So that would be the company's position that I'm offering up here today as a response to this notice problem and allow us to get moving on this project and meet your statutory deadlines that appear elsewhere.
Staff, anything to add to Mr. Kenneke's comments?
Staff also believes that notice to the taxpayer would be adequate notice and would meet the statutory requirements. And we do have a 30-day deadline, so we're working within a very short amount of time, so staff really appreciates that TransCanada is willing to work with us. And turnaround time appears can be very quick.
Can you remind the commissioners when that 30-day time period begins?
Begins upon the date of filing, as I understand it.
Okay. Mr. Smith?
Yeah, obviously the term the record owner, raises at least some question, about how deep we have to go. We encountered this. The first time this statute has ever been used was Groton II. And as our experience there showed, I think that digging down to the absolute ultimate level of ownership interest is very expensive. And I don't know that, I'm not sure that enough is accomplished that way. And we had several landowner situations there where we had 10, 11 landowners for one piece of ground, that those occur largely through inheritances, that kind of thing. We were sending notices out to people in Los Angeles and all over. And that, technically, one could maybe argue that's what this statute means. But, I think maybe a reasonable construction of this is that the record owner who really operates as an agent for all of the owners of the property and entitled to receive notice of taxes, which for most landowners, that's the most important notice you get in a year, probably is sufficient compliance with the statute to meet its intent. And it would save a huge amount of money and a huge amount of... It just makes this practically doable. One question I had, is there anything that might be recommended in the way of doing some level of testing related to the accuracy of that, or do you think that's not necessary, Mr. Kenneke? I guess the tax rolls, usually those are pretty darn reliable because that's how business gets done in the state. As in Mr. Smith testing to see whether notice was actually received and whether it was... Well, maybe I'm off the wall. I was thinking more in terms of are we really getting notice out. But I guess the other question is, I think the idea here is that in our daily lives, whoever it is that receives that tax notice... I own several pieces of property myself, both one I live on and several that I don't. And I happen to be a person that gets all those tax bills for myself and my siblings. And somehow we manage to operate just fine. They know what the taxes are and what they owe and so on and so on. And so practically speaking for us, I've never seen a problem with it. Again, as you know, there's at least a minor level of legal risk here because of the possibility that somebody, a judge, might construe the statute to require absolute, down to the tiniest interest notice here. But, I think the company, if we go this route, you have to go forward knowing that's at least a possibility. Although I think if the commission formally issues an order adopting this as a reasonable procedure, it's going to probably be hard for somebody to overcome the fact that it is. Well, I appreciate your last comment, and I would adhere to that. I think it would be hard if the commission ordered this after considering it. Notice is going to be given to people in several practical ways. The commission certainly, I'm sure, going to advertise however many meetings it determines of where they're going to be, the time, so on and so forth. We, of course, have to engage in negotiations with the landowners who are directly affected, and this will be a topic of conversation all up and down the pipeline for people who are resident here and who will be affected. One
discussion point about the pipeline is that, you know, it's oh, let's think of it in terms of it, as opposed to, say, the Turkey plant in Huron, which is going to provide, going to be an ongoing addition to that community and provide burdens on and benefits to other parts and facets of that community. Once the pipeline has been built, it's going to lay there in the ground and do its job, and a few people are going to work at the pumping stations, but it's not going to be the overwhelming change to society once it's done that perhaps a facility of, the Turkey plant nature would be, if you get my drift. And so the notice that's required, I think, is somewhat less than it would be for, well, let's pick on Big Stone, too. That's a plant of a similar lifestyle-changing nature, perhaps, to that area, that this isn't really going to be once it's been constructed and lays in the ground and the oil, you know, pumps through it. So I would tend to think that really the practical nature of being able to provide the notice to those taxpayers of record, for parcels of property that have multiple owners, they have set up themselves a system whereby someone gets that tax notice and does what has to be done with it. So we're not asking them to change their system while they operate with respect to the property. Whosever name is first on the list has been getting that and dealing with it, and generally dealing with the property in a business sense with the consent of the remainder of any, you know, separate landowners or people who would be joint holders with them. So we're fitting this process into a process that's working for those people. I would have no way of knowing how many parcels up and down the pipeline have multiple owners. The myriad nature of the way people hold property would lead no way to test or find out what that would be. We'd simply have to go forward with it, provide that kind of notice, and then rely on the remainder of the process to make sure that people's input was gathered into the system, which has been laid out.
Thanks very much, Mr. Kennecke. Any other comments from... Mr. Smith.
I have just one last. Would staff and the applicant believe that the notice we do send out might advise the recipient that it's his or her obligation then to advise any other co-owners of property?
This is Kara for staff. I think that's a great idea, and I know we did that on the Groton project as well. We advise the... whoever received the letter, the notice included a request for them to please get back to us if they're not the person that should be notified. So I think that sort of information will be helpful and help us in locating and notifying the correct person if that person is indeed not them.
Ms. Van Bakken, there are a large number of counties that this project is passing through. Do we have, you noticed it's going to be a challenge to get in under the 30-day deadline. Are we in danger of not meeting that deadline?
I don't think so. I think we can do it. I will note that the statutes certainly appear to protect the applicant, to keep the process moving. So there's no stall, there's no delay. In speaking with the applicant, they've indicated they'll certainly work with us if we need extended time, which I can't foresee being much longer than days or a week, weeks. They certainly are willing to work with us, but I think we can do it. I'm going to work hard at getting it done. I know staff certainly will help me with that.
Great. Thanks very much. Other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Commissioner Hansen.
I'll just make a comment, and that is, Mr. Kennecke, I think your job notice is extremely important in these type of situations, and I think that, as you're well aware, I think your job has been facilitated to a great extent by the performance that has taken place by the company up to this juncture. I've been very pleased with the public information that's been released, the press releases, the meetings, public meetings that have taken place that they've taken upon themselves to go out and about and chat with folks, the way they have handled relationships with perhaps they outsourced some of the work that they did from environmental or from siting that they were doing, but the feedback that I've gotten has been that those folks have been very personable, and people have appreciated their visits with them as they've run into them. Also, the website has been very beneficial. The packets of information that they've sent out has been extremely helpful. And I recognize that in situations of this nature that it's not all, you don't always know the answers to the questions. People assume that if you're building a pipeline, you know exactly where it's going to go and when it's going to go in, and whether it's going to be 10 feet on this side of the fence or 20 feet on that side of the road. And you don't know that when you start the process. And the feedback that I have received when I've called, and of course you expect they're going to treat a commissioner differently than they might someone else, but I don't announce that I'm a commissioner. I just check as if I'm a citizen, and they've treated me very, very well. And I do have some experience in this because with the Lewis and Clark Rural Water Supply System going through Iowa and Minnesota and South Dakota, I recognize there's huge challenges from the other side of the fence. So I just would like to say that I appreciate the performance of the company up to this juncture and look forward to continuing that type of a relationship.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will pass that along to the people who've engaged me to help them with this. Thank you.
Any further comments or questions? Perhaps we'll turn to Ms. Van Bakker and see specifically again what we'd like the Commissioner to do with this second question. This is to authorize the Executive Director to hire a consultant to help gather that list of names with county assessors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the question is now obsolete. And no, I do not think we need to enter into contracts with a consultant. And instead, staff would ask that the commission order TransCanada to compose and compile such a list of landowners and to send it off and receive the notice person, the taxpayer, and get that back to staff as quickly as possible, and we'll get started on our notice.
Doesn't the statute require that it's one notice is sent by the company, but then at some point in the process, isn't there one required that the commission send?
Actually, this particular circumstance, we're discussing the notice that that commission must send. Mm-hmm. This is not a notice that TransCanada has to send. The note in an energy conversion facility, I believe it is, in that circumstance specifically, both staff and the company must do it, but that situation obviously isn't the case here, so this is just a notice that we must send.
Sure, no, thank you. I confused those two statutes. Thanks very much. Okay. Commissioner Hanson?
I just couldn't help but notice Mr. Kennecke's eyebrows were moving a little bit there as the suggested process was mentioned. Is that clear? What do we need to articulate it differently?
I don't think so. I when Ms. Van Bakker said, have the commission order TransCanada, that, of course, perks my ears. My client's being okay. Ordered to do something, I tend to pay more attention. But as she moved through that, then I think we understand completely each other that TransCanada is going to assemble this information, provide it to the county assessors, and we would expect to, we're going to be heavy users of courthouse services throughout the project, and I presume more than one person has showed up bearing donuts and juice or what have you so far. We'll probably have to do that to get, and the assessors are helpful, and I don't think this is a particularly busy time of year for them. They're not doing assessments. Some of them are getting ready, of course, for their tax hearings, but I was assured by the Clark County assessor that that didn't seem onerous to him. We'll try and get that back. We might adopt a revolving process whereby you send what you've got done out on Wednesday and don't wait till Thursday or Friday until you get it all done in order to keep the thing going. I took a stab when we were talking about 144 half sections of property if you had a 36-mile, six-township-long county. So we're really not talking about anything too onerous. We just have to find out who they are and provide that information and let as far as the staff composing their notice out, leave that for them to decide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you,
Fred. Ms. Van Bakker.
I guess I'll just ask Commissioners a question. Would you prefer it if we came before you again in the event we can't make that 30 day time frame notice time frame? Or should we at this point ask for the ability to extend?
If I could be heard, commissioners, on that, I'm very cognizant of creating potential appeal spots for people to come up with, and I would much rather, if the commission was going to apply the waiver statute, that we'd have a subsequent hearing whereby we can maybe outline some facts, a factual basis for the commission to make a determination, rather than do that in advance here today. I'd much rather do that later if necessary.
That's makes sense. Thanks. So we have a motion on the table. I would just move that the commission approve the notification process that's been outlined by TransCanada's representation and that staff agrees with. If I get that right, anybody want to make any suggested changes? All right. The motion's on the table. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks for everybody's patience in dealing with that. The final question, at least that's on our agenda, is shall the commission approve hearing locations and a hearing schedule? I didn't see any information on that in the docket. Ms. Van Bakker, do you have additional information?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Staff gathered, along with Ms. Forney, regarding your schedules and the commission's schedule, and we came up with four different locations that staff would recommend. This pipeline is going to cross through portions of 10 different counties total. And SDCL 4941B16 requires that we have hearing locations as close as reasonably possible to the pipeline. So with that being said, staff looked at Yankton, Salem, Clark, and Britton as locations to hold such hearings and looked specifically at June 25th through 28th. There was previously another hearing scheduled for those dates, and it's since been, looks like it's going to be delayed. So those dates appear to be open at this time. And of course, all that's subject to finality, but four specific dates, four specific locations.
What were the dates again, Karen? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ms. Van Bakker.
June 25th through the 28th.
Would it be the staff's intention to also have us move the regularly scheduled commission meeting for that Tuesday to one of those locations?
Yes, Commissioner.
Okay, great. Commissioner Hansen?
I'm just wondering if there is a challenge with those dates. Do we need to approve the dates at this meeting, or can we simply approve the locations? And if there isn't a big challenge with the dates, it might turn out it's a little earlier or a little later.
Can we perhaps approve both the schedule and the locations, but also empower staff to make alterations to those as necessary?
And just to note, the time constraints are severe on this thing. So there just isn't a whole lot of flexibility. And so I think kind of pinning us down to something as early as possible is a good idea. And again, we haven't heard from Mr. Kennecke on this plan, so.
Well, perhaps that's the appropriate next step. Mr. Kennecke.
Thank you, commissioners. First, let me say there's nobody at TransCanada that doesn't like talking about this project. It's been my experience from top to bottom. They want to come out and talk about the project, and if I heard Commissioner Hansen right, that would mirror his experience. I would love to talk about the project. I will tell you that hearings have been scheduled in other affected states. North Dakota has scheduled two hearings. Illinois scheduled one hearing. Four would be more than that. We would agree with staff that given the proximity of the pipeline to Yankton and the river crossing and those sorts of things, the hearing in Yankton seems particularly appropriate given the number of people who would be interested, potentially affected. Makes a lot of sense. My thought was having two hearings at equidistant points further up the pipeline was perhaps preferable to having three. there will be, you know, the commissioners have more experience at public hearings probably than I do, but there will be a certain number of people who come and won't, they'll be too shy to ask their own question and hope that somebody else brings it up. And they're more likely to have their question brought up and can receive an answer in a meeting of a larger size where there's 40 or 60 people as opposed to 15 or 20. And if you combine them and broaden that out, I would suspect that you might satisfy those people perhaps more than otherwise would be the case. But that's in your discretion, and you know much better than I do how to say that. The other thing I grapple with is I wonder if participation wouldn't be better if the participants could combine a trip to town for parts to have their propane tank filled by groceries or what have you in one of the larger communities, and, oh, by the way, let's stop at the pipeline meeting, then perhaps it would be in Clark. I mean, I grew up in Clear Lake, and if someone would have said they're having a meeting over in Hayti about the pipeline that's going through, I'd have thought, geez, a meeting in Hayti probably isn't that important. Not to denigrate Hayti, they would have said the same thing about Clear Lake. Who am I kidding? But I just wonder about that, and I throw that out for the commission's thought process to see if maybe they would think otherwise. I don't have a strong feeling TransCanada doesn't, but Britain is right up hard against the North Dakota border. Are we helping the North Dakotans more by a Britain listening meeting than we are? I don't know. Those are just things for you to consider, and I look forward to your resolution of it. And I can't be more clear that the people at TransCanada want to come out and talk about the pipeline. There's no question about that.
Well, we certainly don't want to do anything for the North Dakotans. Did you have some... I don't know that I disagree with anything you said, Mr. Kennecke. Did you have, you know, if you're more interested, I hear you say three meetings, Yankton and two others up the pipeline?
That was what our thought was.
Did you have locations in mind? Because, you know, it's all good to bash Hayti, but, you know.
It really becomes a question of would you have them in Aberdeen or Mitchell or Huron as opposed to having them in the Clarks and DeSmits and Howards? I don't know the answer to that. You've got much more experience at having those kind of meetings. I can't say. In fact, I don't know what contacts you've gotten and questions from people. You might have pockets of interest out there that I don't know about.
Well, and this is just me talking, and I'm wrong as much as I'm right. But I do think choosing locations that are closer to the pipeline, even if they are more rural, is better than moving. I mean, you know, Mitchell and Aberdeen are getting a little ways off the pipeline. I understand people, you know, there's something to be said for having it in a commerce center. You know, I don't mind having three meetings instead of four, but more wary of moving to the Class 1 municipalities, I guess. Other commissioners' thoughts?
Of course,
Yankton's a Class 1. I don't mean to disparage that great community either.
I agree with you, Commissioner Hansen. I think, or Johnson, I'd rather have them very close to the pipeline, and community size, I don't think... as was proved in Irene, I don't think that with our cell phone meeting, I don't think that's going to deter attendance. As was suggested to me by Mr. Rizloff, maybe Clark and Britton could be combined into one in Webster. Otherwise, and we could maybe move the Salem meeting north just a hair up to another one. I personally don't, like I said, I don't feel... size is of the town is as important as it is to being close. That's just my opinion.
Ms. Van Bakken, can you provide some insight as to why four meetings perhaps make more sense than three?
Not necessarily, Mr. Chairman. That was just the brainstorm that staff had and simply our recommendation at this point. We just want to be sure we're close enough that there won't be a long drive for anyone with gas now at $3. You know, just want to be sure that we give plenty of opportunity for everyone to attend that may be interested.
I have the map here, Commissioners. Do you want to look at this?
Mr. Hansen?
I'm compelled to say something, as long as you folks might be working on insulting all of the Class 1 communities in this market. I'm the one that's going to be running for office next, so I need to say that I love all of the communities. I think I think that it's an excellent suggestion. I appreciate Ms. Van Bockeren's passion in making certain that everybody gets the opportunity to be heard on this and to travel to it. But I do think that when you start looking at communities that are closer to the North Dakota border, perhaps those folks will drive just as far to get to Webster, will drive to Webster or some spot of that nature in order to participate in this. So I think three would certainly suffice, and it would just be a matter of finding those locations. Yankton, by the same side of the token as being as far south and close to Nebraska as to the border, and perhaps we need to look at that one as well.
Seems to me if the commission were going to do three, Webster and Howard make pretty good sense. But again, I think there is a strong argument made for four as well. We probably just need to make a decision and move on. Commissioner Colbeck, Commissioner Hansen, any thoughts as to whether three or four is most appropriate?
I'm thinking three meetings equally spaced along the pipeline I think would be sufficient. Try to leave you in an hour each way. So I'll motion that we have three meetings with the locations and times to be discussed later.
If we could, let's go ahead and pick locations and times at least on a tentative basis. So that we can start to give people an idea of when and where we might be. I don't know, are Howard and Webster equidistant?
Well, Minor, we would be here, and here, Bramble, Carthage.
Well, and the only thought I had about moving from Alec to Howard is, do you get a little bit closer to some of those folks? Because from Alec to Webster is a big drive. That's a pretty big gap now.
That's 2 hours, I think.
Yeah, Howard gets you a little closer. But maybe, I don't know how close, you know, I know the pipeline goes through Minor County, but what's the proximity to Howard to... I forget what part of the county, part of Minor County Howard is in. Is it central or... Of course, all county seats are in the central, but... Okay. Did you want to... Okay, we have a motion before us. We have some commissioners that seem to think four makes sense. We've got discussions about Howard and Webster. Commissioner Hansen, do you have anything else to add?
After looking at the map, it would be easier. I don't know if time would be easier, but as far as equally spacing four would be a lot easier than three.
Well, it seems to me it's tough not to err on the side of an additional meeting.
Okay.
This is a project of enormous scope, and I know that we are having twice as many meetings as North Dakota is. If we approve four, we are twice as diligent as North Dakotans are. And so... As a result, I would make a substitute motion, if it's acceptable to my colleague, that we have four meetings in the locations proposed by staff and the time frame proposed by staff, and that we empower the executive director to make necessary amendments to those locations or times as necessary, and that we wouldn't have to have an open meeting, but that she would just inform commissioners in writing of those changes. That passes muster?
I think it does.
Okay. Great. Anyone who'd be able to fiddle with the wording at all, or I think we on track? Okay. Motion's been made. Is there any discussion on the particular motion? Again, we're voting on the substitute motion. All those in favor will signify by saying aye. Colbeck?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. Is there any? Are there any other questions to come before the commission on this item?
Not from staff.
Mr. Kennecke?
No, commissioners, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Okay. With that, we are done with our addendum. We'll return to the main agenda, and I will just note that there are 8 announcements. I will not read them all, but I will note that the commission has a very busy next month coming up. We do have commission meetings May 22nd, commission meetings June 5th and June 26th.
PUC offices will also be closed May 28th in observance of Memorial Day. Thank you very much. We stand adjourned.